Down we hurried, and when quite close to the station we met two small boys, 10 or 12 years of age. I asked these lads where the manager's house was situated. They did not answer. They gave us one look, a comprehensive look that did not need to be repeated. Then they ran from us as fast as their legs would carry them. We reached the outskirts of the station and passed through the digesting house, which was dark inside. Emerging at the other end, we met an old man, who started as if he had seen the devil himself, and gave us no time to ask any question. He hurried away. This greeting was not friendly. Then we came to the wharf, where the man in charge stuck to his station. I asked him if Mr. Sorrel, the manager, was in the house. "Yes," he said, as he stared at us. "We would like to see him," said I. "Who are you?" he asked. "We have lost our ship and come over the island," I replied. "You have come over the island?" he said in a tone of entire disbelief. The man went towards the manager's house, and we followed him. I learned afterwards that he said to Mr. Sorrel, "There are three funny-looking men outside who say they have come over the island and they know you. I have left them outside." A very necessary precaution from his point of view. Mr. Sorrel came to the door and said, "Well, don't you know me?" I said. "I know your voice," he replied doubtfully. "You're the mate of the Daisy." "My name is Shackleton," I said. Immediately he put out his hand and said, "Come in, come in." "Tell me, when was the war over?" I asked. "The war is not over," he answered. "Millions are being killed. Europe is mad. The world is mad." Mr. Sorrel's hospitality had no bounds. He would scarcely let us wait to remove our freezing boots before he took us into his house and gave us seats in a warm and comfortable room. We were in no condition to sit in anybody's house until we had washed and got into clean clothes, but the kindness of the station manager was proof even against the unpleasantness of being in a room with us. He gave us coffee and cakes in the Norwegian fashion, and then showed us upstairs to the bathroom, where we shed our rags and scrubbed ourselves luxuriously. Mr. Sorla's kindness did not end with his personal care for the three wayfarers who had come to his door. While we were washing, he gave orders for one of the whaling vessels to be prepared at once, in order that it might leave that night for the other side of the island and pick up the three men there. The whalers knew King Haakon Bay, though they never worked on that side of the island. Soon we were clean again. Then we put on delightful new clothes supplied from the station stores and got rid of our superfluous hair. Within an hour or two we had ceased to be savages and had become civilized men again. Then came a splendid meal, while Mr. Sorla told us of the arrangements he had made, and we discussed plans for the rescue of the main party on Elephant Island. I arranged that Worsley should go with the relief ship to show the exact spot where the carpenter and his two companions were camped, while I started to prepare for the relief of the party on Elephant Island. The whaling vessel that was going round to King Haakon Bay was expected back on the Monday morning, and was to call at Grytviken Harbour, the port from which we had sailed in December 1914, in order that the magistrate resident there might be informed of the fate of the Endurance. It was possible that letters were awaiting us there. Worsley went aboard the whaler at 10 o'clock that night and turned in. The next day the relief ship entered King Haakon Bay, and he reached Peggotty Camp in a boat. The three men were delighted beyond measure to know that we had made the crossing in safety, and that their wait under the upturned James Caird was ended. Curiously enough, they did not recognize Worsley, who had left them a hairy, dirty ruffian, and returned his spruce and shaven self. They thought he was one of the whalers. When one of them asked why no member of the party had come round with the relief, Worsley said, "What do you mean?" "We thought the boss or one of the others would come round," they explained. "What's the matter with you?" said Worsley. Then it suddenly dawned upon them that they were talking to the man who had been their close companion for a year and a half. Within a few minutes the whalers had moved our bits of gear into their boat. They towed off the James Caird and hoisted her to the deck of their ship. Then they started on the return journey. Just at dusk on Monday afternoon they entered Stromness Bay, where the men of the whaling station mustered on the beach to receive the rescued party and to examine with professional interest the boat we had navigated across 800 miles of the stormy ocean they knew so well. When I look back at those days, I have no doubt that Providence guided us, not only across those snowfields, but across the storm-white sea that separated Elephant Island from our landing place on South Georgia. I know that during that long and racking march of 36 hours over the unnamed mountains and glaciers of South Georgia, it seemed to me often that we were 4, not 3. I said nothing to my companions on the point, but afterwards Worsley said to me, "Boss, I had a curious feeling on the march that there was another person with us." Crean confessed to the same idea. One feels the dearth of human words, the roughness of mortal speech in trying to describe things intangible. But a record of our journeys would be incomplete without a reference to a subject very near to our hearts.